From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, Zorba, some topics to talk over.
Yes, we're going to talk about urgent care, the rise in urgent care, and actually the rise in urgent care as a business model and how it affects our emergency room and primary docs. And vasectomies may actually increase the risk of prostate cancer. We're going to discuss this very controversial study.
And our recipe.
Chicory, tangerine, and pomegranate salad. It's that time of year when we want to have great salads, and this is a great invention.
Got to tell you, I don't know how chicory tastes, but the rest of it sounds pretty good.
And it is, Tom. You will like this, I promise you.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll-free. And to the phones we go now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in Clyde Park, Montana. Hi.
Hello, Tom and Dr. Zorba. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
We have a question about peanut butter. My partner of 20 years, a retired rancher, and me more a little bit more of a townie, have just had our separate peanut butters for about 20 years.
Huh.
He, of course, likes the non-natural, and I like the natural. Then about a half year ago, he did quite a restrictive diet, and it was definitely laid out that he should only use natural. The diet turned out to be very good, and I just assumed we could get rid of all the other stuff. But he went and checked out the labels very carefully, and there's such little difference, I really wondered if it was an important difference.
It's quite interesting because I've looked at peanut butter before, and there was an excellent article in Cook's Illustrated, one of my absolutely favorite magazines, about, quote, natural peanut butter and then peanut butter that is more processed. Things like Jif and Skippy and all of the other brands, and whether or not there's really a nutritional difference between them. Now, you know, as you know, there's a taste difference between them. And natural peanut butter, the oil will naturally sort of settle out, so you have to mix it up. And the other peanut butter, you're smiling.
Yeah.
What kind of peanut butter do you like, Tom?
I like the other kind, the not natural.
The non-natural.
And my wife likes the natural. Because she believes that everything that says natural on it is better than something that says.
And in our house, I like the natural, and my wife likes the non-natural because she likes that. So maybe every house in America has the same way, and we're just looking at that. From a nutritional standpoint, the difference is nil. In other words, when you look at it, it's about the same. The non-natural, and I don't think we should really call it non-natural. We ought to call it processed.
Yeah.
It's homogenized. Basically, so the oil doesn't separate out because people like it. It tends to last longer. I can't remember exactly what the process is. But natural peanut butter, if you let it stay, it can develop a sort of rancid sort of smell to it if it stays for a long time in the house. So I think if we look from a point of view of taste, that's what I would look at. But from a point of view of really how your body processes it, I don't think there's really very much of a difference.
Oddly enough, the calories for a serving of the processed came out to bolster his argument slightly smaller than the natural. The sodium is slightly higher, the sugar is slightly higher, and I guess I'd also ask, there are some additives to prevent the separation. Is there anything negative about that? I just don't like additives, but all it said was cottonseed, soybean, and rapeseed to prevent separation.
Right. That's exactly what they do. They add different oils to prevent the separation. Now, it is more processed. There's no doubt about it. I mean, natural peanut butter, they take the peanuts, grind it up, and they put it in a jar. They don't do anything else to it. And processed peanuts, they emulsify it and put other oils in it to keep the peanut oil from separating out from others. And when I read the review, and I haven't read it recently, there pretty much wasn't anything else. I don't know if there was anything else in there. But you bring up an important point. You don't like processed. And I think that is a very important style issue that you have to address. And there's the taste issue. There's also, what is a serving? So it may be that the difference in the serving, when they talk about it, is the serving may be a tablespoonful or two tablespoonfuls. And when you actually measure it, one is slightly heavier than the other because it's more dense, and the other product may have more air. So I think the difference in the serving size is probably pretty marginal. In other words, the number of calories are marginal. Besides, who measures out peanut butter exactly,
right?
Well, I guess my question is answered. If both of you have two sets of peanut butter in your family, I expect that's what will happen.
Exactly. Now, I have a question for you, because you said he's a rancher and you're a townie. How big is the town that you are a townie of?
Well, we found a place halfway between the town and the ranch, and it's a very tiny town, and we're outside it. So it seems the best of all compromises.
Yeah, you guys really compromise on everything, don't you?
Except peanut butter.
Oh, yeah. But I meant you agree to disagree.
We can handle it. And we love your program. Both of us love it very much, and we listen regularly. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. So they may have a peanut butter difference, but when it comes to public radio, clearly there's no difference at all. They love public radio.
What's the last time you had a peanut butter sandwich?
You know, I'm not big on peanut butter, but I have about once a month. I just have this craving for peanut butter and grape jelly. I think of my mother when I have it, although I used to have it on Wonder Bread. Now I've got it on, I don't know, some kind of whole wheat bread, so I feel better about it.
We've got a jar of it. I haven't had a peanut butter sandwich in
And when?
Years.
The last time? Well,
years.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do today?
I'm not going to have a peanut
Come on.
Butter sandwich.
You know what? I am going to bring a peanut butter sandwich in next week on Great Bread, and I promise you will love it. How does that sound?
I'll eat it, but then I won't be able to talk. Well, Zorba put past 1-800-462-7413. It's toll-free. And, Zorba, you said you had a few words to say about urgent care.
Well, it's an interesting thing. It turns out urgent care sites, maligned as Doc in a Box. You know, where Doc in a Box came from?
No.
Jack in a Box. A drive-in.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's what. Why not Doc under the arches? You know, I mean, come on. We don't have any Jack in Boxes in Wisconsin. You know, Doc in the Arch would be just as good. But these are urgent care centers, and they actually serve a purpose. Now, here's the problem. The problem is a lot of people don't have a primary care doctor. Something happens. They're not sure where to go. They don't have somebody to call. They don't have somebody to email. We've got a wonderful email in the practice I have. It's called Epic. We have something called My Chart. When people are on it, they can send an email to us. We can answer it. My nurses can often answer the questions. You know, they know the way that I practice.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't do that. They end up in the emergency room. And before you know it, they've got $150, $250, $500 visit that could be handled in an urgent care center.
Yeah, urgent care, I see as sort of a step between your doctor and the emergency room.
And it's an after-hours place that's useful. Here it is. It's 5 o'clock in the evening. You know your doc is closed. You know, where do you go? Well, you may go to the emergency room, but the reality is urgent care serves a purpose, especially from that, you know, a lot of people do have after-hours, but they're decreased. But from that 5 o'clock to 11 o'clock, there are things that happen in our life.
And you're out of town?
You're out of town.
And something happens?
Something happens. You need to go. So it turns out there's some recent information that says urgent cares are booming, and they're actually profitable. So the question is, where does profit play a role in medicine? In other words, is profit okay to take in medicine? And the answer is, if it improves care, because that's the way the American medical system is, it's not a single-payer system, it's not a Canadian system, it's a system that's based on profit, that might be good, because there may be more urgent care centers that open near you that are useful.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't get what the issue is, because all medical care is profitable.
Well, I will give you a good example.
Yeah.
Good example for me. So here it is. I'm in my office. I initially worked with old Dr. Kellogg, old Dr. Dukeshine. I thought he was old when I first met him, because he had been in World War II and Korea. Well, he's still around at 95 and sharp as a tack.
Yeah.
So it's kind of amazing. Anyway, we're in an old building. We had one clinic, specialty clinic, that we referred to called the Jackson Clinic for years. I mentioned that we wanted a new building multiple times. They wouldn't build us a building. You know, our building was old. We didn't have the money. They were getting ready to retire. I was a young doc. I didn't have the money. Boom. The competition next door called the Dean Clinic, which I'm a member of, said, hey, we'll take your specialty, Claire. We'll build you a brand new building. Profit produced a new building in my small town of Oregon. We gave better medical service because they were looking for profit. That's the way the American medical system works, whether you like it or not. Urgent care centers, if they're profitable, will prop up, and they're better than going to the emergency room.
Oh, yeah.
And they're, like you said, they're a step between your doctor and what would be emergent care.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Pastor. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Hey, I suffer from severe tinnitus. You know, my head just rings constantly. It's loud, it's distressing, and it's often depressing. So I have two questions for you. Number one, what is the state of medical science in treating and curing tinnitus? And number two, where in this country, or the world for that matter, is the center of research and expertise in this area?
Yeah, good questions. How long have you had it?
It's been severe for a little over 4 months. I've had mild tinnitus for about 10 years, and then very suddenly, literally overnight, I woke up and something triggered in my head. And since it's been severe, I can't ignore it anymore.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, as of this time, as we speak, there is no cure for tinnitus. We know that tinnitus is associated. You've read about it, undoubtedly. And you know that it's often associated with hearing loss. Do you have a hearing loss associated with it?
I have mild hearing loss, actually, in both ears. The doctors I have seen have told me that this is just the combined effects of loud noises over my lifetime. Things like motorcycle riding and concerts and various other loud noise exposure.
Right. You know, the treatment that we have for tinnitus is a suboptimal treatment, and that's to get the mind to listen to something else to basically ignore the tinnitus. So I want to go a little bit about hearing. The hearing is very complex. I mean, just like, you know, eyes are complex. You know, there are things that we ignore with our eyes. There are things that we look at with our eyes. We look at text when we want to read, and we ignore everything outside of text. We concentrate. That's the word that we use when we're looking at something. And with our ears, we do the same thing. We ignore certain sounds. If you're quiet in a room, you may hear a motor, maybe other things going on, quote, in the background, and that's because we're not listening to it. But if we're trying to find something in the background, like we're listening for a child crying, we pay attention to that. And so, you know, the issue with tinnitus is trying to get the brain to ignore it, because we can't at this point reverse the ear damage that we feel is associated with tinnitus. And no one knows why, you know, because with our eyes, it's not as if as we're you have a decrease in vision that all of a sudden we have bright lights, you know, that are flashing with our eyes. That's not the case. So that was the long way of telling you that we don't know anything about tinnitus. And I don't know where there is research that's going on for tinnitus. I have no idea. I've not looked it up in
research.
That's
kind of ridiculous, because so many people suffer from this.
Right. Well, there's got to be research that's going on. You've Googled this. What have you found on your Google search?
A lot of companies. I've been to the University of Missouri, where they're supposedly, or Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, you know, and seen a so-called expert there.
Yeah, what did he say to you? I like so-called because you know right away what that means, like didn't do squat. So what did he say? You've got tinnitus. Thank you very much.
He's tinnitus. There's nothing they can do about it. And he actually was saying I should get into mindfulness meditation as a way to divert my attention.
So, you know, that quote, so-called expert, brought up something very interesting, which is meditation and moving the mind to something else, because that's what we do all the time. And when people get new hearing aids, they go, I can't stand it anymore. I hear everything. And it takes them a while. Tom is smiling now.
Yeah.
What happened when you got your hearing aids, Tom?
Well, I don't think I had that sensation.
Well, a lot of people have that, where they go, because they don't wear them all the time, and all of a sudden they're hearing all the background noise that people with normal hearing ignore. The doc, the so-called expert, had a process that may be useful. So what I would recommend that you try is go to the web. There's mindfulness meditation on the web all over the place. You don't have to go personally to a yoga trainer, but you can also do that. And you may want to do that because taking your mind and trying to put it somewhere else may be useful, because that's what your mind is doing automatically when you're listening to music. You're ignoring the tinnitus. And once again, when your brain goes back to the tinnitus, it comes into the forefront. So that's all we have at this moment.
I understand. That's what I'm led to believe. It's unfortunate, and I hope that someday they can come up with a cure or something.
It would be useful. If they come up with a cure, I promise that I will mention it on my show.
Yeah. Okay, I'll listen for it.
That's thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks
for
sharing.
Thank you very much.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It.
We appreciate the call. I feel so lucky, knock on wood.
It's yes.
Gone for, at least
yes.
for now. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take an email question from a listener, Catherine of Random Lake, Wisconsin. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, would you talk about your opinions of Thai massage or Thai bodywork and stretching? It is the oldest documented form of massage and seems to me to be the most thorough and provides the most relief."
Well, it's one form of massage. And, like Reiki, deep tissue massage, Swedish massage, you've got to find, and I love massages, you have to find the massage therapist that's right for you. And there are different types of massages that work well. My wife, for instance, loves foot massages. I can't even touch my own sole. I mean, I find it very difficult to have a foot massage, so I don't like that at all. I go to a massage therapist that does a combination. So my opinion is that this is a style issue, just like some people like Thai food, other people like American food, some people like fish, steaks, vegan. You find a massage that works for you, especially if you've got pain, and it can be very, very useful to basically alleviate the pain that you have.
Have a healthy living question for us? Zorba's happy to work out the knots. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. Or don't forget, we are on Facebook.
We have our recipe coming up. You'll want to hang around for that. More of your calls, of course. Some more interesting topics to talk over. Our medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. Callers waiting, an open line now for you. But before we get back to the phones, Zorba, chicory, tangerine, and pomegranate salad.
That's right. Salads are great. And sometimes salads are maligned. I feel sorry for the salad people. It's like, I'm having another salad and people think it's sort of iceberg salad.
Oh, salads can be delicious.
Absolutely delicious. Now, chicory is kind of interesting because chicory, common chicory, it's a woody perennial. It's a plant. It's got bright blue flowers. And there are many, many forms of chicory that are actually done. Chicory often is used in a salad. It's like endive, and you may find it at a farmer's market. I know the chicory, probably that's a different form of chicory, is used in coffee
in
New Orleans. And it was used in coffee, by the way, so that they could take the coffee beans and not use as many coffee beans because coffee was expensive. The beans were expensive.
Well, that's delicious.
Yeah,
coffee.
I love chicory coffee.
Yeah.
You love New Orleans. You've gone there a few times, haven't you?
Yes.
Haven't you? And had chicory at, what is the name of that cafe?
Dumond. Café du Monde.
Café du Monde. Remember what they have at Café du Monde? They have beignets.
Yeah.
Delicious beignets. Yeah. The highest fat donut in the world.
Orange juice, beignets, and coffee for like $7.
That's wonderful. And you're New Orleans, and it's the middle of the winter. I am game. However, I'm going to move back to the chicory salad because we are not going to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So let's do it. It's chicory, tangerine, and pomegranate salad.
Yep.
So start out with two medium shallots, sliced 1/8 inch thick.
to medium shallots, sliced 1/8
That's right.
Inch
and they're really nice amount. Third of a cup of red wine vinegar.
Third of a cup red wine vinegar.
Tablespoonful of sugar.
One big tea sugar.
1.5 tablespoonfuls of kosher salt.
A tablespoon and a half of kosher salt. A
couple of tablespoonfuls of tangerine juice. The way you get tangerine juice is you get a tangerine
and juice it. Okay.
That's right.
Two big tea of tangerine.
Right. I probably just put in everything. I mean, what are you going to do with the rest of the tangerine? Well, you could drink the rest of it. 2 teaspoons of whole grain mustard seed.
2 little tea whole grain mustard seed.
Like mushroom seeds. 1/4 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper.
1/4 little tea pepper.
2 tablespoonfuls of olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
Okay, and then you're going to do mixed. You're going to use some chicory, a pound. You can use escarole. You can use radicchio, some curly endive. But you want it to be this mixed stuff that you like that has kind of a slightly, I would call, a bitter flavor. Wash it, dry it. Tear it into bite-sized peaches, pieces.
A pound of that.
That's right. A cup of tangerine segments. You're going to take another tangerine. You're going to make a little some segments out
there. Cup of tangerine segments.
And 1/2 cup of pomegranate seeds.
1/2 cup pomegranate seeds.
Exactly. Okay. So prepare an ice water bath by filling the water halfway with ice and water. Bring a small saucepan of well-salted water into a boil over high heat. Add the shallots. Blanch them until tender, about 30 seconds. Drain it in the ice water bath. In other words, you're cooling it suddenly. Set it aside. Then combine the vinegar, sugar, teaspoon of salt in a small saucepan. Bring to boil over medium heat, stirring until the sugar is dissolved. Pour the boiling liquid over the reserved shallots. So you're putting this over the shallots, and you're basically kind of pickling them until they're slightly wilted. They've lost their sharp taste because shallots can have a sharp taste. Then drain that into a strainer. Put it into a large heat-proof salad bowl, collecting any of the liquid underneath. Then whisk the tangerine juice, mustard, remaining 1/2 teaspoon of salt and pepper into this liquid. Slowly drizzle the olive oil in while you're whisking it. Taste it, add a little salt if you want to, and then combine it. Add all the leaves that you have, the chicory, which is basically escarole, radicchio, and endive together. Put in the tangerine segments together. Toss it, top with the pomegranate seed. Put the shallots around the side with the liquid, and you've got something that's really good. Sounds a little complex, but you actually
say,
it
probably tastes good, but it sounds really too hard to put together.
Wait a minute. Yeah. For you, who orders this at a restaurant, it's really simple.
For people that make their own salad, this is a lot of work.
It's a bit of work. First of all, you got to take all of those leaves. You got to wash them. Okay, that's one thing. Yeah. You've got to combine the liquid together to basically make the dressing. And then you're taking the shallots. You're warming them up, putting them in an ice water bath, draining them, and then putting them in the liquid. Mm-hmm. The prep time is about 12 minutes.
Okay.
Now,
that doesn't sound bad.
Do you ever waste 12 minutes of your life?
Oh.
Is it 12 minutes?
Every half hour I waste 12 minutes.
At least 12 minutes. What you have to do, Tom, is you have to think of prep for your salad as exercise time. Oh. You're exercising your mind. Instead of going to one of those websites to use your brain, do a complex recipe. Yeah. I'm serious. Instead of doing crossword puzzles, which, by the way, I hate. I have not completed a crossword puzzle since high school because I hate them.
I'm not smart enough to do crossword
However, you're smart enough to do this complex recipe because you've got to get all the stuff together. And I'm not being facetious about this. Yeah. There's something about a prep of a recipe that can help train your mind to do complex things that can improve your brain and keep away Alzheimer's disease. This is the anti-Alzheimer's recipe.
Okay.
For Tom Clark.
I'll accept that. And to get a copy of this, I turn on my computer.
You plug in the computer, you put it together, you boot up DOS, and then what you do is you go through your landline and go to zorbapastor.org, and it'll load in about 5 to 10 minutes. You can look at that recipe, all of our other fine recipes, and through DOS or anywhere you want to. I don't think the young folks today even know what DOS is. It's sort of like World War I. It's ancient history. That's ZorbaPastor.org. You know, in the peanut gallery, I'm looking at the producers. They're laughing. I have a computer downstairs that will still run DOS. That's I've got it in a floppy drive, a 5 1/4 inch floppy drive. I'm going to try to plug it in. That's ZorbaPastor.org. Or you can find us through Facebook. When there was DOS, who even thought of Facebook? I was a billionaire. I'm sorry. ZorbaPastor.org. This is too much fun. Find us, folks.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. And back to the phones now, Zorba, as we welcome a Jacksonville, Florida listener. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I had the care of my elderly mother in Michigan before she passed away, and when I took over her care, I discovered that she was still driving, and I wanted to get her license away from her, so I found out in Michigan you could take them to the Driver's License Bureau, and they would exchange the license for just a Michigan ID. In the process of doing that, the clerk asked my mother if she wanted to continue to be an organ donor, and my mother said, yes, please take the whole thing. You can have it all. So my mom had no arrangements made for her death, so I went home and looked up on the Internet a company called MedCure, an organization that accepted total body, and my mom filled out the paperwork and went ahead and did that, and it worked really, really well. But in the process of doing this, they had some screening questions, and that's what my question is today. One thing they seemed interested in avoiding was liver disease, and they asked, did you ever have hepatitis? And I was curious to know, is there a test to tell that's easy and expensive to find out if you ever have had that?
Oh, yes, of course. You know, your doctor can do a hepatitis screening test to see if you've ever had a hepatitis. We do that all the time in the course of that. Now, here's the issue. If you're doing a hepatitis screen for a medical problem, your insurance should cover it. You know, it's a medical problem. It's a test. You might have a deductible. You might not. But it's because you're trying to make a diagnosis as a doctor. If you have to have a hepatitis test because you're going to give away your body, your insurance may not cover it because it's not part of the diagnosis. I have no idea how much the test costs, but we're talking about significant money if you're testing for Hep A, Hep B, and Hep C. So I would answer the question in the way that you would answer it, she has no history of hepatitis. If they want to actually test for hepatitis, they can do that. Now, they can't do it after she dies. But I think what they're asking you is, do you have a history of hepatitis? Most people know if they've had hepatitis. If it's Hep A, they have often turned yellow. If it's Hep B or Hep C, sometimes they know, sometimes they have a blood test. If they're asking you the question and they're not asking you for a blood test, then they're asking for you, do you have a history of hepatitis that is known? Otherwise, if it were more specific, they would say, do you have hepatitis? Have you had a blood test to prove that you have not had hepatitis?
Okay.
Now, I don't know why they're actually asking that, because I don't know. Hepatitis can be spread, and I don't know if hepatitis can be spread when you're actually, when you're actually doing, we'll say, a dissection. I don't know the answer to that, and that may be something that they're looking for. And if anyone knows that, looks it up on the web or on the net, because I don't have a computer in front of me when we're doing the show. You certainly can load our email box with answers for that. Yeah. It's a good question. I'd also write a letter to the company and say, why do you want to know about hepatitis? Hepatitis.
Okay. I'll do that.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, Dr. Zorba.
A pleasure. Pleasure to talk with you.
1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a Buffalo, New York listener, joins us now. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
My question is relationship to my young daughter. She's approximately 6 years old at the time. She was initially diagnosed by our family doctor as having ringworm in her hair, in her head, scalp. And so we received some oral medicine to give her. And upon completion of that serving of medicine, it seemed to be that she still had the ringworm in her head. So we gave her a second dose of the medicine with the hopes, of course, that it would cure it. However, my wife seems to think that it has reoccurred and that she's concerned about continuing giving her the oral medicine. So I'm wondering, are there some topical solutions that effectively treat it without her having to continually take the oral solution?
basically is a fungal type infection that we get. And the reason why it's called ringworm is there's often there's central clearing. Mm. So it looks like a ring. In other words, it's the way the rash looks, the way the abnormal rash looks on the scalp and the skin, you know, on part of the body. So it's not a worm. Basically, you know, it's a, if you will, it's a fungal, you know, a type of infection. And we usually treat it with topicals. There's a topical solution called Nizoral, N-I-Z-O-R-A-L, which is ketoconazole, big long name, ketoconazole. Uh-huh. And it comes in a shampoo and you put it on, leave it on for 5 minutes, and then you rinse it off. And it's very, very effective to get rid of ringworm. And that's what I would recommend. And one of the ways you put it on, you have your daughter sit in a shower, put on shampoo on your head, and they get a shower cap. Put the shower cap on top of it, you know, so that it actually stays on for about 5 minutes. Take the shower cap off. She may be showering and staying nice and warm in the shower, and then you wash it off. And you basically do that often, you know, every day for like a week, and then once or twice a week until the ring, you know, until this basically this infection has cleared itself. And it's highly effective. It's topical. It's not systemic. And most importantly, you can repeat it if it doesn't work. So call up your doctor, ask for ketoconazole. It's also called Nizoral. It's a generic shampoo, and use it with your daughter. That's what I do.
Now, is it prescription-based,
yeah,
or is it something that can overcome?
That is a prescription shampoo. Now, there is a non-prescription treatment that may also work, and that's Celsin Blue. So if you don't want to call your doc, you can try that out. Same thing, Celsin Blue. Leave it on the scalp for about 5 minutes, shower cap on top, every single day for a week. After that, 2 to 3 times a week, and see if that works. That's not a prescription. That's not quite as effective as the ketoconazole, but for many people, it will work. And I would stay away from the pills. They obviously have not worked for your daughter. Once it clears, it may not come back.
Oh, okay. Thank you so very much. I appreciate the info, and I'll definitely look into that.
Thank you.
I'd like to also add that my mother and I, we really enjoy your program. So we encourage you to keep up the good work, and I'll put that info to use.
Glad you and your mother like the program.
Thank you so much. And before the break, Zorba, it's time to let one of our listeners give us a piece of their mind. It's your favorite.
Which piece?
What?
Piece of their mind.
Well, I'm going to
What piece of the mind? Is
I'm
it like
tell you what piece.
Is it like the hippocampus or, you know, or the corpus callosum? I just want to know which piece.
It's the piece that has to do with probiotics.
Oh, great.
Today's question was posted to our Facebook page from a listener named Jessica. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, why is it that you promote yogurt as having probiotics but not promoting things such as kombucha, kefir, or fermented foods? And also, you should point out the fact that chia seeds contain more omega-3s than fish, yet carry less of a risk of contamination."
Okay, so first of all, we'll go to chia seeds. We know that eating fish once or twice a week is very useful because it prevents heart attacks and stroke. Mm-hmm. We don't know if it's the omega-3 fatty acids in fish. That's it. In other words, we don't know. We know that alters triglycerides in the body, and the chia seeds do it too, but we don't know. There's no evidence right now that eating chia seeds will reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes. So I don't recommend chia seeds. I recommend fish, and I'm away from fish oil anymore. Now, getting to the probiotics.
Kombucha, kefir.
Well, kefir is like yogurt, so I should mention kefir. Kefir is sort of a drinkable yogurt. It's very, very similar. Kombucha, I've never heard of kombucha.
Kombucha.
Yeah. Well, I've never tried it.
K-O-M-B-U-C-H-A.
Well, if it's fermented and it has lactobacillus, I should recommend it. So, you know what? Blinded with blindsight, wherever that came from, I will now recommend kombucha. Can you spell kombucha?
Yes.
Go ahead.
K-O-M-B-U-C-H-A.
You know, I think
it's right here on the email.
I think that is probably very useful for people who do crossword puzzles, and I don't do them. So kombucha. And you know what? In Scrabble, it'll be dynamite. It'll almost be good as kabuki. Kabuki, which would be another good.
Has the question been fermenting in your brain for too long? Don't wait. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
A topic to talk about that's coming up next. More of your calls are Medical Mythbuster 2, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, vasectomies may increase prostate cancer risk,
right.
It says.
So
here.
Let's look at the study. Study is going to raise a lot of eyebrows, and it's going to be a little controversial.
A lot of guys' ears perked up.
They perk up at this. Journal of Clinical Oncology, it's a very good journal. Study came out of Harvard. They review data, so it's a retrospective study reviewing data, nearly 50,000 men, 40 to 75. They looked at, this is in the, these are in the long-term studies that Harvard do. That Harvard does. Sorry, that Harvard do. Sorry, grammar police. It's Harvard does. Around 12,000 men had vasectomies. There were 6,000 cases of prostate cancer from 1986 to the year 2010. No association between prostate cancer and low-grade prostate cancers and vasectomies. But they found a 20% increase in high-grade, the more lethal type of prostate cancers and vasectomies, 20% increase. There were roughly 19 per 1,000 cases of if you had a vasectomy versus 16 per 1,000 cases over a 24-hour period.
But it's not really
It's a very small number. So you've got 1,000 men having vasectomies, and for over a 25-year period, 1,000 men over 25 years, so 16 got prostate cancer out of this 1,000. They didn't have a vasectomy. 19 got prostate cancer, this I did, if they did. So you look at it and you go, 20% increase, that looks like a lot. But when you look at the absolute risk, it's three more cases per 1,000 men.
Yeah, this isn't even worth talking about.
No, it is worth talking about, but the number is small. And this is why you have to look at data. You have to say, wow, a 20% increase, I'm not going to have a vasectomy because it's a 20% increase. In reality, it's three more per 1,000. So in other words, 999, In other words, it's only three. It's 9993 do not have prostate cancer, and three do.
Like I said, this is not even worth talking about.
Well, it is, because what happens is, as soon as an article like this comes out in the newspaper, 20% increase of having prostate cancer, immediately people go, well, wait a minute, I'm not going to have a vasectomy. This is an issue. There are a lot of things that you can do to decrease your risk of sudden death. Let's not forget the prostate cancer. It's only one cause, one place of dying early. They didn't look at whether or not if you're at risk, and this is a tiny risk, if eating more tomatoes will make a difference. They didn't notice that the incidence of prostate cancer has been dropping over the last 20 years, and we don't know why. So they didn't look at those things. I think it's three more cases per 1,000 men, and the risk is actually very, very small.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And our next caller, Zorba, is a listener in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, good day.
Yeah, how can we help?
Well, I have been diagnosed by the VA with having arthritis. I'll go back to my childhood. In my early childhood days, I had the rheumatic fever. Before that, I was supposed to, from what my parents told me, I was a normal, healthy kid. But after the rheumatic fever, they said I was somewhat sluggish. Since then, I always feel cold. I like it really hot.
Mm-hmm.
And I seem to be in pain, which having that as a child, you'd think that's just normal.
Uh-huh.
But the thing that I question about is, if I keep myself hot during the night where I really sweat, or if I can get into a hot tub, I'm not achy and stiff with arthritis.
Oh, sure. Hot tubs are wonderful for arthritis. Saunas are great for arthritis. You know, heating pads, we often use heat for arthritis. They're wonderful. You know, rheumatic fever, the most common side effect years ago was rheumatic heart. But arthritis is not you know, your, I don't know if your arthritis was from rheumatic fever or from other things. That's kind of the question. But what's your question?
Well, how is it that if I have a sweat such that I wake up soaking wet in the morning, that I'm not stiff, I'm not in pain, and almost function normally?
If I don't do that,
I can hardly move lots of times.
Sure. I have no idea. I don't have the foggiest idea why, but people tell me things like that. They'll have night sweats, and they'll say, I sweated it out, and now I feel better. Hmm. You know, they'll say that. And I don't know what's going on. There's something that's going on while you're sleeping. You know, maybe your internal thermostat is set up, so you're sweating. You know, if you're using the same bed covers and the heat's the same in the room, we can't talk about the external heat or the bed covers. But it's not an uncommon thing. You know, it's not uncommon for people who don't have infections to say things like this, and I don't know what's going on. There's something going on clearly with the inflammatory response in your body. We know that arthritis has an inflammatory component, and when your internal heat goes up, it's somehow affecting that inflammatory component. It may be affecting prostaglandins, which are important with arthritis, and you feel better, but frankly, if there's something you can do to make it work, I would do it. You know, people go into heat all the time and they feel better. I have achy joints. I don't have much in the way of arthritis, but when I'm in the hot tub, I get out and I feel good. Why? I don't know. It's never been studied. You know, science, there's a lot of science that we don't know. And this is, I think, is a good example. So keep it up. It's a non-pharmaceutical way of helping with your arthritis.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
You're
thanks
welcome.
So much. We appreciate the call. At 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, it's myth-busting time again. Today's medical myth-buster comes to us from Julie, who's listening in St. Charles, Illinois. She writes, "Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom. I have a question about sunscreen. In the past, I've always just bought the sunscreen that's on sale. Is there reason to be concerned about the oxybenzone fragrances and parabens found in common sunscreens? I read a recent article discussing the increasing rate of skin cancer and want to make sure that the products in typical sunscreens are not contributing to this increase. Thank you for your help."
So sunscreens, when we talk about it, FDA has approved sunscreen chemicals considering, with a development of generally recognized as safe. Okay, generally recognized as safe means we don't have hard data that it's bad. And these have been around for a long, long time. Mm. Now, there are people who don't like sunscreens. They think that they're bad. Yeah. And the fact is, the best way to stay out of the sun is to stay out of the sun.
Sure.
You know, wear a long sleeve shirt when you're on the golf course, wear a hat so you don't have it, you know, go out with a parasol. You don't have to use sunscreen, or just stay inside during the summer months and don't go out so you don't have to use it. But the reality is, we know the more sun you have, the more at risk you are for basal cell skin cancer, squamous cell skin cancer, and melanoma. Australia, recently had an Australian friend, they have the highest rate of melanoma in the world. And since they started using sunscreen, and they have sunscreen on the playgrounds, they have it all over the country, they had a big push, they have dropped their risk of melanoma tremendously and the risk of death.
Really?
Now, let's look at the toxicity of the chemicals. So you have a group, the Environmental Working Group, and they do research. And what they do is they have a wonderful website. They look at great things. And basically, through their website, people then have a belief system. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong. Oxybenzone, on their website, I've got some information on there, detected in nearly every American found in mother's milk. So in other words, there's some study that showed that it's detectable on people who have it. Now, that doesn't mean that its detection is, it could be 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, it could be a very small rate. And it says that it believes, this is the Environmental Working Group, it works like estrogen in the body, alters sperm production in animals. Sounds terrible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Something you would want to stay with. A high rate of skin allergy. And then they say may cause endometriosis. So you look at this and you go, well, I'm not going to use that sunscreen. That's bad.
Or has there been any testing of any of
these? Well, you know, then what they do is they quote some references and some tests that were done, which, of course, are important. Generally recognized as safe does not mean something assures you it is 100% safe.
Yeah.
In other words, every time you use a chemical on your body, there's a risk that it's unsafe. I think that we live in a society which has risks. Balance your risk. That's what you do. So you drive a car. There's a risk you will die in the car every time you drive that car. So you have to take that risk and minimize it by wearing seatbelts, driving in the right car, driving the right way. It's the same with sunscreen. Is there a risk? Maybe there's a teeny tiny risk, but I don't find any evidence that persuades me that we should take sunscreens off the market and we should stop using them.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to shed some light on? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org and find us on Facebook. And don't forget, if you want to chime in on the sunscreen controversy, please do it on a sunny day.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, we welcome a listener in Lancaster, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, Dr. Pastor, I have heard it is better to cook with grapeseed oil since it has a higher flash point, thus less likely to smoke or burn as quick as olive oil, and has equal health benefits. Is this true?
Well, let's talk about oils. What do you cook with your oil? Are you talking about stir fries or what are you using?
Yeah, stir fries or anything that I'm going to, if I fry anything, it would be in a lighter oil like that.
Uh-huh. Interesting articles that were in Cook's Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen concerning olive oil and taste. And they discovered that when you cook with olive oil and you heat it up, that basically the benefits, the taste benefits of olive oil tend to disappear. And extra virgin olive oil, which is what I still use to cook all the time, the taste benefits tend to disappear as you use that. The issue with olive oil is we have good evidence from the Mediterranean diet and multiple studies that olive oil in itself has benefits. And the best evidence comes from the New England Journal of Medicine article that came out about 2 years ago now that showed that olive oil enriched diet, basically an ounce or two a day of olive oil, reduced the heart attack risk quite significantly. So the question is whether or not other oils would do the same thing. And the answer is, well, we don't know. And a study that large will never, ever be done. It may never be done again, but it's certainly not going to be done with another form of oil. So I don't know if the benefits are the same. You know, the taste may be different, but I don't know. So have you found a difference in taste when you use it?
Yes, and I do like it. And the place that I buy them has actual flavored ones.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I can get a jalapeno-flavored grapeseed oil or a garlic and basil. They just have some phenomenal different flavors.
Sounds wonderful. Let me ask you, what do you use? Do you use it on your salads, too?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. What I think I would do, since you've got, obviously, you have a purveyor of really, you know, good oils that taste really differently, I'd probably do a combination. I'd probably use some olive oil maybe on my salad, and I would cook with the other oil. I would go back and forth. I think I like the health benefits of olive oil because I know that they're there, so I would use them. But I'd probably, if I like the taste of the other oil, then I would use that in those things for which the taste really makes a difference. I'd probably do a balance of 50-50. That way you're getting some olive oil within that.
I do use some olive oil. I have it mixed with a 15-year-old balsamic vinegar. I've been able to find down in Dubuque.
Uh-huh. So, as I said, I would do that because we know the olive oil data is there and we don't know the data with other oils. And if you need a super high flash point, peanut oil is the way to go.
Sounds wonderful. Well, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for your call.
I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thanks. We appreciate the call. 1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And before we head out today, Zorba, let's flip the script for a minute. As you know, Zorba, I usually read you the email questions, but this time we have a listener question directed at me. So, Zorba, You're doing my job now, so you have big shoes to fill. So use your best radio voice.
I will do it, Tom, and I will try to do it with aplomb. Okay, Tom, let's take an email question from a listener in Illinois named Darlene. She writes, Tom has said he gets dizzy at times, and I believe he said he went to a physical therapist. So he does exercise to relieve his dizziness? I would love to know what kind of exercises he does for this, and thank you so much for your show.
Very good, Sarla. Well, you've had some dizzy stuff, too, so you know this as well as I do, but I'll go through what they're doing with me right now, and you can amend that any way you want.
Absolutely.
I've had two physical therapy sessions. The guy, I think, is pretty good. He puts me on a table and twists me around. It's interesting because he puts a thing over my eyes, and they can tell whether the inner ear crystals are in the right place by looking at the eye movement.
At the fluttering of the eyes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so he twists me around. First he says, I can see where the crystals are loose. He twists me around, put them back in place, and then sits me up and says, okay, try to be careful between now and the time I see you again. Try not to bend down. Try to keep your head above your heart. Okay. When you tie your shoes, be careful. Don't bend. It's very hard not to bend. And then come back in a week. And I can tell right away, right after I leave the office and do anything, this thing has come So I wait a week. I've seen him twice now, and I still have the dizzy stuff. But I asked him the last time, hey, what are the chances that this is actually going to work? And he said, well, I've been doing this for 20 years, and I can count on one hand the number of times I haven't been successful.
So over time, this works.
I have great confidence now that this is going to work. So your experience in this?
I think it works. I think it works over time. It's called Epley's Maneuver. We put it on the website. We'll put it on the website again. Finding a good physical therapist is good. And I've got a question for you, Tom.
Yeah.
You said it was hard to keep from bending over. Did you succeed in not bending over?
I can't. Not bend over in a week? I mean, you can't. How can you go through a week without needing to go down? I mean, I suppose I could bend up my knees, maybe lie down and pick something.
It's tough.
It's very hard.
Exactly.
So we'll see.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for sharing that with us. So if you've got a healthy question for Tom, post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook.
See you next week, Tom.
Stay well. If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org, or remember, we're all over Facebook.
And you can call us, of course, anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Colburn. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444, ask for program number 0802Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.